Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Lars Ulrich.
Welcome to a special edition of The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Metallica are without doubt the biggest heavy rock band in the world. With a staggering 100 million albums sold worldwide and a fan base that extends beyond the metal world and onto stadiums in nearly every territory on the planet. And like many groups, Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich is the spokesman for the group that he co-founded in 1980 with singer James Hetfield, who provides the angst-driven yin to Ulrich's more thoughtful, analytical yang. Lars's personality and jaw-dropping drumming style has propelled his band across 9 albums and helped make heavy metal the mainstream genre that it is today. Here, in a rare and characteristically articulate interview, he discusses his childhood in his native Denmark, how a career in professional tennis was hijacked by a love of British heavy rock, as well as the band's evolution from bars to clubs and into arenas with the groundbreaking Black Album. He also talks about his passion for Ennio Morricone, Metallica's recent move into movie making with the film Through the Never, as well as his friendship with Noel Gallagher and his passion for the music of the Arctic Monkeys, not to mention what Metallica are up to next. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, opposite my bedroom on the top floor of the house that I grew up in Copenhagen, Denmark, my dad had his music room, which actually, now that I think about it, was may have been the biggest room in the house. And there were a lot of records in there, a lot of vinyl, obviously. And at that time, the earliest I remember was maybe 68, 69. It was a lot of Miles Davis, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, The Stones.
So a very wide range.
Yeah, that type of stuff, yeah. And so I would sit and listen to a lot of his stuff. And then I started being turned on to actually a lot of British music. Probably I started listening to rock music maybe around 72, 73, sort of the Sweet, Slade, Status Quo. And a lot of the stuff that was sort of the hits, you know, like remember like Alvin Stardust and remember like Sailor and, you know.
Some of it good, some of it not so good.
Well, you know, we can't pass judgment, but we can look back with fondness on the stuff that we grew up with. And then in 1973, my dad took me to see Deep Purple. And then I went and bought my first sort of serious record the day after the concert, which was Deep Purple's Fireball. And then I was off to the races.
We'll be right back. And that was the thing, you instantly had a connection with rock.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, if you have one of those, you know, the moments, one of those, what is it, Quentin Tarantino says, a moment of clarity, that's as close as I got to that, at least in music. So that was Deep Purple in 73, and then it sort of went from there.
Because in the film, in Through the Never, there's this character who's kind of like a young guy, he's like a young kind of roadie, come gopher. Were you ever that guy hanging out at gigs for your heroes? I'll do anything.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was sort of like a runner, or in England you call them tea boys or whatever. Yeah, you know,
everything runs on tea.
Yeah. Well, I used to want to try to get quite close to the bands. All the bands in Denmark stayed at the Plaza Hotel, right opposite the main train station, and I would sort of loiter there. This was a few years later, maybe 77, 78. I had the good fortune of meeting Richie Blackmore, Phil Lynott, wow, Ronnie Dio. There weren't a lot of kids hanging out at hotels in Copenhagen in the late 70s to meet at least these guys. I didn't hang out to meet Sweet or Slade or any of those guys, where there may have been more girls or whatever, but it was pretty lonely out there on the sidewalk in front of the Plaza Hotel in 1978. But I got to meet Richie Blackmore and Dio and Phil Lynott and members of Thin Lizzy and so on.
When did you first fall in love with Diamond Head? Because that's a band that you've name-checked a lot over the years as kind of being someone that you had another seminal moment with.
Sure. So Q, a few years later, and now I'm living in Los Angeles. Copenhagen is a distant memory, and I'm sort of, in my mind, is I'm on the trajectory to become a tennis player like my father. But the thing that kept me alive as I was sort of dealing with tennis and Los Angeles and foreign countries and so on was Sounds magazine. I had a subscription to Sounds, and so every week when that came in the mailbox, that was the highlight. And Jeff Barton and a few of the other rock writers were sort of writing a lot about the rock scene in England, as the so-called new wave of British heavy metal, and the Iron Maidens and the Def Leppards and the Diamond Heads and the Saxons and all this stuff. Brute Force was a compilation record that MCA put out in the fall of 1980, and I got that sent. There was a company called Bullet Records up in, I think up in Staffordshire or something, up by Leeds Way or up in that direction. And I started buying mail order records through Bullet Records. I kid you not. And so anyway, long story short, Brute Force showed up in the mail. And the first song was It's Electric by Diamond Head. And that was another one of those wacky moments where it was like, I think I heard that song 6,000 times that day. And then I think somewhere that was kind of what made me want to be in a band. Right as that was going on, the tennis thing was kind of dissipating in my life. I was realizing that even though I was sort of a ranked tennis player in Denmark, in Los Angeles on the street that I lived on, I wasn't even in the top 10, you know, because of the level of competition and so on. So the tennis thing kind of dissipated, and Diamond Head sent me in the direction of wanting to be in a band.
I'm gonna make a million dollars.
The very first piece of music recorded under the Metallica name was Hit the Lights, wasn't it? Is that right?
Yes. First original piece of music.
First original piece of music. And it features in the film, and it features on the soundtrack.
Yes, it does. It even closes the film. How about that?
You must have a real fondness for that track. To kind of, it must be nice to go and kind of play it again and just think, yeah, some kind of cyclical. We have come back to the start.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, in interviews a year later, you can certainly find those kind of full circle things. It's always been a... I think it felt a strong song, maybe not a particularly, it's not like one of the hits, and I use that word very loosely, by the way, but
it's... I think you can say hits.
Well, you can say it. I'll say it in quotes. But Hit the Lights was the first piece of music that James and I wrote together. And so obviously, you know, it sort of goes back to day one and has been with us and opened the first record, blah, blah, blah. It's a song we still like playing, and you know, the thing about Metallica is that at any given moment, more or less, we can, you know, when we're on tour and when we're sort of playing gigs, we have about 60 or 70 songs that we actually more or less again can play. Sort of, you know, we're not the kind of band that sort of we have 18 songs and then we go out and just play those for a full tour. We get very easily a little restless, so we have. On the Death Magnetic tour, which was the last sort of continuous two-year tour we did, we played, I think, close to 70 songs on that tour, and we changed the set list every single night. We haven't played the same set list twice in, I think, over 10 years.
Whoa!
So we play, and now we have to keep that streak going, of course. So actually, when I put a set list together, I have somebody check that we haven't played the set list before, just so I can say that in interviews at the BBC. But Hit the Lights is one of those songs that we sort of can always come back to, and we play, you know, on tour maybe once a week or whatever, and we thought it should be in the movie.
Yeah!
The Ecstasy of Gold by Ennio Morricone is your opening music. It's been your opening music for a long time. It's, you hear it in the film.
For a long time, yeah. Like three decades in, yeah.
Why that piece of music? Or is this one of those questions where everyone's expecting some really deep answer?
Well, no. I mean, listen, credit where credit's due. We rolled out to Glamorous New Jersey in 1983. We were sent some money from a local promoter slash sort of record guy slash just sort of entrepreneur guy who had heard our demo. And he sent us some money. We threw our stuff in a U-Haul truck and drove across country and landed in New Jersey. And we walked into his house. And I think within a day, Johnny Zazula was his name, who was our first manager for a couple, 2-3 years, and gave us our first record deal, put Kill 'Em All Out. God bless him. He said that he had the perfect piece of music to open our shows. So he played us The Ecstasy of Gold, and that still opens our shows 30 years later. And we've used it in our videos and in our home DVDs, and we've used it in, you know, and there's clips of Clint Eastwood on our screens, and we've sort of been in contact with the master himself, you know,
really?
And Mr. Morricone, and he's blessed us, and it's been very cool, and it's been a big part of kind of, I guess, our identity. So it's very cool.
That was The Ecstasy of Gold by Ennio Morricone, part of the score for the 1966 film The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. And that's the first thing you'll hear at any Metallica concert. And my guest on the first time today is Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich.
This is Six Music.
Six
Music. BBC Radio Six Music. Thank you.
Christ I seek and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open mind for a different view. And nothing else matters. Never care for what they do. Never care for what they know. But I know. So close.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Everett with my guest today, Metallica drummer and heavy rock hero Lars Ulrich. And you've just heard the epic Nothing Else Matters from Metallica's fifth self-titled album in 1991, a record almost universally known as the Black Album. It would also go on to sell 30 million copies worldwide, introducing metal to the mainstream and changing the band's lives.
And then you got the Black Album, which did what an album like that is not supposed to do. Records like that aren't supposed to be that big. And, I mean, how did you cope with that? Because this is a thing I find with bands, is you spend your whole life building to, we want to be huge, we want as many people to listen to our music as possible, we want to stay true to our vision. But then you get everything. Then you get everything you could possibly
do. Yeah, I mean,
for.
You know, you got to remember that we were fortunate in that you know, by the time the Black Album hit, we were five records into what we were doing. So it was sort of, and it was the kind of what I would call the classic European way. It was, you know, first album, second album bigger, third album bigger than the second, fourth album. You know, each album's kind of stepped up. A lot of our peers, Guns N' Roses, came out of nowhere and sold 100 gazillion records. You know, Nirvana came more or less out of nowhere and sold 100 gazillion records. Pearl Jam, their first record was the biggest, you know what I mean? So a lot of our peers and the bands that we grew up with in the 80s and 90s had their first record be ginormous. So our thing was kind of just step by step, which was fortunate because by the time the Black Album hit, we were 10 years into it. And maybe we were...
ready for it? Or is that...
Well, I don't want to say that in the context of being disrespectful to the other bands that I just mentioned, so I won't say it that way, but just, you know, we'd been around the block a few times and traveled around the world a few times and had kind of paid our dues, I guess is one way of saying it. So, and also, you know, when the Black Album came out, it was a... You know, in the record industry, there's a term called legs. You know, this record's got legs. I mean, it wasn't like it came out and then overnight it was 15 million. I mean, it was, what was it, 3 years? I mean, it was the record that kept giving, you know, just single after single. And all of a sudden you're sort of six singles in and it's 3 years later and 20 million. And it's sort of like, huh? Well, but it was very cool and we're very fortunate. There was a lot of things that... lined up right, you know. I mean, it's not just the record, it was also the climate at the time, and obviously a little bit of luck. I mean, it was a good time for rock at that time with a lot of great things happening and up in Seattle, and you know, it was a pretty cool period.
I want to talk about some of the bands that you love as well, because you're a big Arctic Monkeys fan, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
We love
yes.
that band over here. Can you remember first
I've spotted of, that yes
can you, good drummer as well, fine drummer,
insane, absolutely the hands down the best drummer in, as you call over, indie music.
When did you first come into contact with him?
Well, I'm a fairly avid follower of the English music press. So what was that, 2006 maybe, when the NME started writing about... I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor was like the, and there was a fake, there was that little EP with the Fake Tales of San Francisco, and then... you know, the first record came out and it was one of those classic, like the British media builds it up before they even have like a single out. But these guys actually could support it in terms of the music. And then each record just got better and better. And I haven't really gotten a chance to sink my teeth into the new record. My 15-year-old is a rabid fan. And we had him on our festival last year, which was really cool and made me look really cool in my son's eye. And I got a chance to introduce him. And Matt is an insane drummer.
To kiss someone, to kick you. There's nothing that you couldn't slip through. Or at least that's the impression I get. Cause you're smooth and you're wet. And she's not aware yet, but she's yours. She'll be saying, use me. Show me the jacuzzi. I imagine that it's there on a plate. You're a rendezvous rate. Means that you'll never be frightened to make them wait for a while. I doubt it's your style not to get what you set out to acquire. The
I want to ask about Some Kind of Monster as well. When you saw that for the first time, when you saw the finished film, was there that kind of icy moment of like, this is too much? People are going to see this. Because weirdly, it's the kind of thing that opened you up to, A, a whole new audience. And people kind of saw you, rather than just people on stage, and saw you as people.
Yeah. Well, there was a bunch of things. I mean, also, you know, there were some people, especially in the rock world, more than in the film world, there were a lot of people in the rock world that thought that that was too much. Mm. It was too transparent. There was too... I'm not sure I want to know that about, you know, my favorite band or whatever. The movie was probably better received in the film world because, you know, the documentaries that really work are the ones that have a story that everybody can relate to. You know, and Some Kind of Monster is not really a story of a rock band. It's a story about relationships, and everybody can relate to, you know, relationships. It's just set against the background of a rock and roll band.
Were you scared of putting it out?
No. In order to undergo that kind of experience, there has to be trust to the filmmaker. And the filmmakers, you know, were Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky, who we had a long relationship with through the Paradise Lost films. And so we trusted them. Well, see, they didn't come in to film the meltdown. They came in to film the making of the next Metallica record. And then the meltdown started happening. So it wasn't, you know, we're melting down, come film us. It was like, how about you come in and document the making of the next record? And then everything went to hell. And then they were filming. And then I think there was one sort of meeting or chat or whatever. It was just like, we trust you. Keep filming as all this crazy stuff's going on, and we trust you. And we sort of went along with it. I mean, the way you say the first time I saw the movie, I mean, obviously, the first time I saw the movie, I'd already seen the movie 100 times. Do you know what I mean? So there wasn't, because we're part of the editing, and we sort of saw it as it went along. It wasn't just presented one day, like, here you go. And, you know, what happens in those types of situations is that, you know, you, I guess you, you third person it, you know. I'm fairly thick skinned, I guess is the way to put it. And so as I sit there and look at, you know, double chins and receding hairlines and silly Danish accents and whatever else, you just kind of go, that's just a character. That's not really me. Do you know what I mean? And you find a way to compartmentalize that to the best of your ability. Maybe I should have some therapy over that. Maybe we should talk about that in therapy. No, we don't do therapy anymore. I forgot. Maybe we're cured.
As we're in Britain, as we talked about indie, I want to ask you about Noel Gallagher, because you love Oasis. You're friends with Noel. When did you first meet him? Because that seemed to be like, you know, you guys publicly got on really well. It was almost like a little bit of a sort of romance.
You're talking about in the past tense?
Well, I mean,
we still do.
How did you first meet him?
Well, first met him in San Francisco when they came and played in at the Fillmore in the spring of 95. I'd been reading a lot about them before, and obviously in all the press, and I thought their language was quite colorful, and and I thought it was kind of interesting. I loved the directness, and then, and this is a true story I've told many times before, I'm reading about these guys, and then I'm driving in my car listening to 105.3 in San Francisco, and there's a song that comes on the radio, and I was listening to this song and going, that's got to be those guys that I read about, because that same attitude that's in the interviews is in this song. And lo and behold, the guy goes, this was a new band from England called Oasis, and this was a song called Supersonic. I was like, wow, that attitude and you know, translate it into the music. That was quite impressive. I'd never experienced anything quite like that. So when they played in San Francisco, I found them, and then I sort of ended up seeing them at quite a few shows around America. And there was a particular show in New Jersey where I think they were short of somebody running their lights. I ended up standing at the light board running shows for running the lights for Oasis in a small club in New Jersey. That's one of those moments I wish I could relive. But anyway, so we, you know, whenever we're in the same zip code or, you know, postal code or whatever you say, we sort of end up crossing paths and hanging out and talking a lot of nonsense. So it's all good.
Talk about Through the Never. When did you first come up with the idea? Because this has been a long time coming, hasn't it? This is a hell of a project. It's huge.
You know, these ideas, they hover. It's probably a good way of saying that. So this idea has been hovering. It's been hovering for probably 15 years. I think it was around 97 that IMAX came to Metallica and asked if we would do a specialty movie with them. It was before that they started showing like Hollywood films and feature films on IMAX. They would do, you know, movies about frogs and scuba diving and mountain climbing expeditions and, you know what I mean, all that type of stuff. So they started just getting into music films, and they wanted to do a music film with Metallica. At that time, the practicalities, the cameras were like the size of small houses, and I mean, it was the whole thing was pretty insane. So we kind of had to walk away from it, but we held on to the idea. And about 4 years ago, we were in Belfast, actually. And we sat around and talked about maybe bringing the big Metallica movie in 3D to the screen. And so we sort of just went to work on that a couple, 3 years ago. And you know, we had no idea what we were throwing ourselves out into, as we never do. It's been a pretty crazy ride for 3 years. And making films is a very different thing than making music. But I've enjoyed it. It's been a little overwhelming and bewildering at times. But now we have a movie that plays in IMAX theaters in 3D. Woo! So there you go.
What's next?
We want to make another record. Obviously, it's been a couple of 4 or 5 years, and I think it's time to make another record. You know, we increasingly, I mean, love doing all these different experiences and festivals and music, you know, movies and whatever else. But obviously, at the core of it is new music, and so it's time to make another record full of new Metallica music.
What's the last song we should play to finish?
Ever?
Anything you want. Hopefully not the end of my career. I mean, the interview hopefully wasn't that bad.
The last song you should finish?
What's the last song?
It's my choice?
Yeah, anything you want.
God damn, that does open it up to quite some possibilities.
Well, everything that's ever been recorded in the history of time is pretty big.
Ever. And it all exists in that microchip that's sitting right there, right? What should we play? I don't know. Spider Dan? What should we play?
Go with My Apocalypse.
My Apocalypse, brought to you by Spider Dan. His first time in London, by the way. So we make him feel welcome.
Then that's the song we should finish on.
From
Thank you very much,
Death
Spider
Magnetic.
Dan.
There you go.
Good to speak to you, Lars.
Back at you. Thank you. Great.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
But you do it anyway. How's it been? Well, I must say for me, please go away. I can put it on if that's what you want. You like to get together, but I'd rather. You have something to prove.
BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now, this is Handpicked.
Hello, this is a shorter version of Handpicked, which is a weekly playlist put together by us here at 6 Music, which you can download in BBC Sounds. Now, usually Handpicked is full of new music, but this time around, we're marking Mental Health Awareness Week with a special sequence of songs chosen by all different musicians who have been asked specifically to share with us the music they turn to when they need something calm and quiet. To find the full version of this special mix, just search Handpicked in BBC Sounds and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.
I don't